Committee on Revenue, our organizational meeting, and to a packed audience today, we welcome you as well. We want to express gratitude to the Legislative Revenue Office. Paul Warner is the Legislative Revenue Officer and helping us set up for today. Joan is assisting, and Robin Wilton is our scribe and clerk today, I guess. So, welcome, Robin. Let's see.
We have two of our economists, too, in the audience, Mr. Chair.
Do they agree together on anything? Two economists? No, huh? They don't. Okay. I didn't think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, for those of you who haven't been on the Revenue Committee, Mazen Malik works on our, kind of does all of our sin taxes, lottery and OLCC and cigarette and other excise taxes. And Steve Meyer is our school finance person. Mary Ayala does our property taxes, and you'll meet her as well.
Okay, great. Thank you, Paul, for that introduction. Now let's see. We're still short just a couple of members and I have seen both of the two that are presently not here, and we have invited both representatives, Phil Barnard and Rosenbaum, had expressed interest in attending. Not necessarily as members of the committee, but as interested parties with regard to revenue. And so we have set a place for them. Now, that won't always be available as a result of the fact that we will be meeting also with the Senate and with an 11-member committee. That's going to be kind of tight. Mm-hmm. But we'll do our best to accommodate members of the House and the Senate to participate with us wherever we can. Today we have an agenda. Which is before you in your packet. We have a schedule of adoption of committee rules, review of the bills passed during the immediate past session, as well as a discussion of adoption of interim committee work plan, and then we'll adjourn before 4 o'clock, I'm assuming. So, are there any additions or objections to the proposal that we have before us today on this meeting? Also take a look at the November 23rd, tomorrow, Wednesday. We will receive the forecast the very first up, and again, the Senate Interim Revenue Committee will be with us here in this room at 8:30 as our guest, and we will also review then at that time and discuss tax expenditures report and then an update of the Master Settlement Agreement, and we will adjourn before noon tomorrow. And we wish you all a happy Thanksgiving and merry traveling. So, back home. Representative Rosenbaum, welcome. It's delightful to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be here.
Now, let's see. Because there are folks that have not been on past revenue committees with us, and my vice chairs are on either side of me from the revenue committee, the regular revenue committee, and they both know of my propensity not to be able to remember names, particularly under any kind of pressure. And so when you see them feed me your name, you'll realize that I've been struggling. So, but I think it would be appropriate, and perhaps we could start with the rose at the end, Representative Rosenbaum, amongst these thorns. Excuse me, but there's Representative Comfort as well, and Representative Berger. But if you just introduce yourselves and just tell us what experience you've had on the Revenue Committee, because Representative Rosenbaum, you have been here before in regular capacity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, especially for calling me a rose. You couldn't say I'm between thorns, though, today, since there's no thorn in my lap. Someone said there is no. So I'm very pleased to be here, though I'm not an official member of the committee. I've had a strong interest in revenue from the very beginning of my career, which coincided with the beginning of the chairs. I was on the House Revenue Committee in my freshman session, and then more recently served on the Interim Joint Task Force on Tax Reform, which then became the House Revenue Committee in the last interim. So, very interested and pleased to be here today.
Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chip Shields, State Representative from Northeast Portland. I have no experience on the Revenue Committee, but I'm looking forward to diving into it.
I'm going to yoke you up to something really heavy here. Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, I'm Scott Bruin, State Representative from District 37, which is primarily Westland and Tualatin. I, too, am a newbie to the Revenue Committee. However, I've had a longstanding interest in tax policy and revenue creation, so I'm just delighted to be here.
Thank you very much. Standing members.
Yes, Representative Betty Comp, House District 22, and I grew a lot during the last session and expect to grow more during the interim, but to know that I have a construction person on one side of me and a realtor on the other, how can I lose? I got to be a winning House member somehow.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm Representative Esquivel from District 6 out of Medford. When I was appointed to the Senate, I was on revenue. Was on revenue during the session, and here I am again.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel.
Mark Hass, I'm up from Beaverton, or I guess I should say it's, you have to be careful now, unincorporated Washington County.
They don't like you, do they?
Third cycle in the interim revenue game, and I'm going to keep doing it until I get it right.
Get it right. Thank you, Representative Hass. Representative Berger, please.
Mr. Chair, members, Vicki Berger, District 20, which is the Salem area. I have served two sessions on revenue and interim revenue, and if I've learned any single thing in that much time, it is that I know Paul Warner's phone number. And it's the thing I would suggest everybody put in their palm pilot first.
Representative
Representative Larry Galizio, Tigard, House District 35, and I was honored to serve this past session on Revenue Committee and look forward to this interim work.
I'm Representative Brian Boquist, 23rd House District. I survived 2 months of Paul Warner's orientation and 6 months of the chair, and I still don't have it right, so I was brought back again.
Representative Arnie Roland, District 9, which is Coos Bay and to Florence, and not any experience with revenue other than we had a little committee between education and some people from revenue during the session. So look forward to this. This is important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Derek Kitts, I'm here to help those of you that don't have it figured out. So I'm also happy to be here.
You're going to help us figure it out, or you're going to tell us how it was figured out?
You just listen to me, you'll be fine.
Okay, we'll know how the cow got out of the barn. And Representative Barnard, it's great to have you here. Please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm a State Representative from House District 11, Central Lynn and Lynn Counties. With the Marion County Court here, which I'm sure we all welcome, I had a problem finding a parking place. That's why I'm late, and I apologize. I'm very pleased that you've allowed me to sit with the committee, although I'm not a member. Revenue issues, of course, are extremely important to all of us, and I expect to learn a lot during the committee meetings.
Thank you, Representative. It's great to have you here, and we do appreciate your getting parked and not just leaving your car out like I do mine. colleagues, we appreciate your attendance here today, and we'll strive to get through the business at hand. The first item that we do have on the agenda today is the adoption of committee rules. And in the folder which you've each been provided, there is a copy of the committee rules. And I'm going to ask a legislative revenue officer if he'll just go down the 10 items that are there, and then we'll have a discussion and then move to adopt. So, Paul?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are pretty standard rules, and so I think you're familiar with most of them and have seen them. I'll just raise a couple of points that periodically come up. One is under number two, a reminder that a quorum is required for any voting decisions, and that would include bill introduction, for example, and the adoption of these rules. But the committee, of course, can meet at any time and receive public testimony with just one member. So that periodically comes up in terms of public testimony or informational testimony. Under number five, the rules are laid out for subcommittees. May be appointed by the chair or the speaker. But typically, what we have done and in the past, certainly during the regular session, is the chair will appoint work groups to work on specific issues where several members of the committee and with staff and perhaps with interested parties will work on particularly complex issues and then come back to the committee. Now, that doesn't require formal minutes and that kind of thing or public notice, so that's just a working group that will try to look at an issue and then report back to the full committee. So,
colleagues, you'll recognize that that has typically been my style, to try and identify those of you who may have interest in specific subjects, be members of the committee or those who are interested, members of the House or other elected legislators, and if you do have interest in those items, or if you appear to be absolutely passive on the item, where I feel like that you may be a really good person to add to the blend of somebody that two other members that are really passionate about something. So if you express absolutely no opinion, you have every bit the same propensity to be thrown into an informal work group. Representative Boquist carried his
weight. We were just talking about that, Mr. Chair.
on several of those, as did many members. And I do, again, want to express my appreciation for those of you who served on informal work groups. And you know, the really great part of that is that so many good things were done in those informal work groups, and we got so much bipartisan legislation out of the informal work groups and passed through the committees and passed and signed into law, that actually I think I've received two awards as a result of that. And I wasn't a member of those work groups, those informal work groups. So, you know, you really make me look great when you can do those things. So, and I probably will, if I err and say something about the subcommittee, please slap my hands and recall to me that we'll use informal work groups, and I've made arrangements for the library and the Legislative Revenue Office to be available for those informal work groups if you need a larger place to meet. So, please, Paul.
Mr. Chair, the last two points there, 9 and 10, I also wanted to raise, and they have to do with a pre-session filing of bills, and of course the majority of members is required, a quorum is necessary for that to happen. And that we would anticipate on your work plan to occur primarily during your last meeting, which would be about a year from now, where your pre-session file bills that usually wind up being assigned to the committee during the regular session. And another reminder is, and this issue comes up periodically, about a committee bill. If it is a member of the committee who has kind of led the discussion and wanted to have a bill introduced, and the committee agrees and votes on that, typically it'll just appear as a bill sponsored by the Committee on Revenue. If you have someone from an outside interest, a constituent, or an interest group that comes forward and says, I'd like for the committee to introduce this, our rules state that it should have that in the title. So it would be a bill introduced by the Committee on Revenue at the request of. And that's typically how we do that, and that way you can identify where the bill originated from.
And I anticipate that we will, any ideas that appear to be salient for the Revenue Committee probably need to be vetted with staff, and then let's kind of work together towards the December meeting of 2006 for a time when we'll have a stack of items that we could introduce on behalf of the full Revenue Committee if we can come to consensus on those issues. Further discussion relative to the kind of standard set of rules that we've got. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, if I could make one comment, then I would make a motion. For the information of this committee, I will be chairing a interim committee dealing specifically with funding education through some sort of a dedicated mechanism, sort of a different way of operating in terms of our, particularly K-12 we'll be focusing on. Any significant output that I see coming, I will certainly talk to you about, because they're tied together, and we're sharing staff. Paul's staff will be working with us, so just FYI. With that, thank you for your indulgence. Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the House, the rules of the House Interim Revenue Committee as stated.
Okay, thank you, Representative Berger. Representative Berger has moved the adoption of the rules as presented to us today by the Legislative Revenue Office and is discussed here in the committee. Is there any objection to the motion? Is there any dissent or objection to the passage of the rules? Hearing and seeing none so ordered, we will then live by the standard rules during this interim call. The next item on the agenda is the review of the revenue bill passed in the 2005 session. And
so, Mr. Chair, I know this will bring back some painful memories for some people to relive the session. And those of you who really want to relive the session in terms of revenue bills and the detail, we do have our revenue measures passed summary that we produced and released in September, so you should all have a packet of that. If you need another copy, we'll be happy to get you one. It's also available on our website. What I copied off for you today for the discussion is just the summary piece, which is the beginning of that report, just the overview section. And just to kind of the intent of this is to set the context for the decisions and try to highlight some of the main policy issues. And in this piece as well, I put down some things that you as a committee during the regular session and as a body as well spent a lot of time working on, but yet we didn't see the resolution of a major bill. And those have resulted in some cases, in task forces that Representative Berger just referred to on the stable school funding, and another one on the reserve fund that there's a task force that's being staffed by the Legislative Fiscal Office. So, but in terms of the session itself, I think there are really two things that shaped policy more than anything and that you spent most of your time dealing with. The first was the change in the economy. And, if you look back on the December forecast that the governor used for his budget in December of 2004 and compared that with the numbers that you used to produce your legislatively adopted budget, general fund was $493 million more for the latter. So that's a pretty significant change over the course of the forecast period. And those of you who were here during the 2003 session remember the reverse, that we were going in the opposite direction by almost an equal amount. So it does certainly change the whole discussion. And you'll see tomorrow when the forecast is released kind of where we are in terms of that trend. I will tell you that as we see the collections come in, we are tracking above forecast. So that, on the income tax, on both corporate and personal income taxes. So the expansion is continuing, and we see the same pattern occurring at the federal level, too. You may see the federal deficit estimates have been coming down as a result of income tax collection. So we tend to track the federal pretty closely because our revenue system actually is fairly similar to theirs. The other thing the other thing to keep in mind about the revenue stream is if you look on that table 2 in the second page, you can see the projected revenue growth for 2005-2007 is 10.4% on a biennial basis. So that's still not a real strong growth rate by historical terms. And you compare that with the mid-90s, we were up around 20% revenue growth. So, we haven't hit that high growth period yet. And in fact, if we use that 2005-2007 legislatively adopted forecast there, you have growth from 99-01, 6 years, of only 11%, so which is less than 2% a year, so less than the inflation rate. So you still don't have a real bright revenue picture compared to where we were in the late 90s, even as the recovery starts to pick up. And of course, the other phenomenon that you're well aware of is that is the elasticity of the income tax, its response to changes in economic conditions. That elasticity is rising as the share of the general fund coming from personal income taxes rises. And I plugged in the number there for 2005-2007. It's 89.5% of your general fund revenue is personal income tax. And that number has been rising. Really, it was in the 60s. In the 60s, it was in the 60 percentiles. and has pretty much steadily risen ever since then. And so now we're right about at 90% for the 0507 forecast. So we're going to, the personal income tax is going to even more than ever drive the general fund. The other issue that the committee spent a great deal of time on was the response to federal policy. And of course, that's always going to be a huge factor for you with a connection through the income tax. The decision of the 03 legislature to move away from the rolling reconnect policy of automatically connecting to changes in tax base left you with a whole series of decisions to make regarding federal changes that took place in 2002 and 2003. And those of you on the committee spent a lot of time working through the implications of that, and discussing what you know what the revenue impacts were, and what was the federal rationale, and so forth. We had the CPAs come in and work through that with you.
Paul, with regard to the current discussions in Washington D.C. and some of the items that are being thrown out, what's the most worrisome of those ideas that you see relative to our current reconnect status?
First of all, Mr. Chair, keep in mind that we have gone back to the rolling reconnect as a result of Senate Bill 31 starting 1105. So you're back into a rolling reconnect type of pattern. The issues that are being discussed at the federal level now, the package we see coming through Congress and moving its way through has some interesting implications. One of the main issues that they've had to deal with is the alternative minimum tax.
Which doesn't really affect Oregon.
Does not really affect us. So it would, however, could significantly affect a number of your constituents if we do see the actual sunsetting of some of these measures that have kept it from affecting more taxpayers, like the exemption level that is scheduled to decline. But that's a potential issue out there. The thing that we have looked at is some of the longer-term discussions around the federal tax reform proposals. You know, the true where the President's Commission had a couple of general proposals. Those would have significant implications for the state. They would basically move back to a broader definition of federal taxable income, which affects us directly because we connect it at the taxable income point.
Paul, one thing with regard, and that's that was the item that jumped out at me, the one thing that I would be concerned about relative to the alternative minimum would be though that alternative, the alternative minimum income carryover from year to year as to how that, if there was a change in the actual alternative minimum law, as to how the alternative minimum carryover would be addressed, and then what effect that would have on the actual federal tax that could be owed, because that could reduce the amounts of federal tax, and you might actually, based upon your federal tax deduction, you might actually have some impact there. I don't know that that would be material, but how the federal government finally treats, if they move away from AMT, how they finally treat the rollover, the annual rollover of excess taxes that are being paid, mm-hmm. could affect us. So I think we need to be cognizant of that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, Mr. Chair. It could affect the timing, certainly. But I think what really, if you look at the alternative minimum tax and kind of what its effect is, it is in effect almost a flat tax, because you're eliminating the effect of deductions. So, and some of the federal tax reform ideas have been to eliminate the alternative minimum, but then go to a much broader tax base and change things like the mortgage interest deduction, change that to a credit. Now, something like that happened, and we're connected at the federal taxable income level, and it becomes a credit, then you would have to make a decision on what you want to do about mortgage interest. And you could either establish a credit at the state level or treat it in some different way. But we would be connected to that kind of change automatically.
Chair recognizes Representative Hass.
Thank you. I had one of those moments a month or two ago when these proposals came out, reading them in the morning paper, where you kind of caught your coffee through your sinus systems and saw the mortgage deduction limit in there. And I remember in 2003, Lane Shetterly and I had that bill, and it never got anywhere because we were so quickly shut down by the realtors. And when I look at you, I didn't mean to.
So I don't blame them.
To see the Bush administration propose the same thing, I was... one of those moments. But still, nobody wants to eliminate the mortgage deduction, I don't think, back in February or here. Well, it was just subsidizing second homes and that sort of thing.
But the proposal was also make it a credit, which would really change how it affects our taxes directly. Because remember, any credit we're not connected to. So in effect, we're if they pull it out of the tax base, it would in effect go back into our tax base, and then you'd have to make a decision as to how you would treat it.
Run that by me again.
You know, as you're going through and calculating your taxes, you go through your adjusted gross income, make a few adjustments to that, and you come up with what your taxable income is, and then you calculate what your tax is, and then below that you have a list of credits that you subtract from your tax, and that gets your ultimate tax that you owe.
And we start with that adjusted gross income, or the taxable income,
before the credits.
And so what happens is that you end up with a different result of where our start from point is, with no compensating credit and no compensating other adjustments. But I also believe that any changes in the federal tax law would probably begin in 06 or maybe even 07, mm-hmm. particularly if you have those kinds of tax law changes. But if that current change were to change in such a fashion so that it would damage Oregon's infrastructure relative to our current taxes. Now, if you say, fine, your taxable income is that much more, and we are connected, then what happens is it's a windfall for Oregon, the state of Oregon, because we do not have it. Yeah, we don't have the deduction is no longer allowed on the federal, and there is no compensating credit. So what happens is it becomes a tremendous windfall. So I think we just need to be vigilant of what it is. But I still wouldn't contemplate that would be any item that would be in discussion until probably sometime in late 06. It really becomes an issue.
Mr. Chair, I think the committee is aware of how long it takes to develop tax policy at the state level. That's certainly true at the federal level.
Can we not hold our breath?
So we may have just balanced the school funding issue.
The other issue, too, at the federal level, I think that perhaps seems to have a lot of support at the federal level, is the idea of basically moving in this direction of a flat tax and repealing one of the biggest deductions, which is state and local taxes. And that would have a huge effect on all the states. We did, by the way, and the Senate revenue proposal that went out last week, they extended the sales tax deduction option that you looked at last session, where you get to choose either sales or income tax as the tax that you deduct, whichever is largest, obviously. So that'll be extended another year, meaning that in Washington, for example, they'll be able to deduct their sales
tax. And we would automatically be reconnected to that.
Yes.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Representative Boquist is recognized.
Mr. Chair, could Paul just give us a quick recap on the where we sit on the QPI at the federal level? I know we ended up with ETI and all that because of the GATT and the WTO, and there was quite a bit of discussion that the QPI may, in fact, end up right back at the GATT of the WTO and be thrown out. What's transpired since the session at the federal level?
It was in Senate Bill 31, where you're right at, Paul.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Berger is recognized.
I am a subscriber to Senator Winter's quarter in the pot for every acronym, and I want to hear Representative Boquist actually say that sentence without one.
I will follow up.
Representative Boquist without acronym.
Vice Chair, of all those work groups I had involving the qualified production activities income deduction and the extraterritorial income exclusion, of course, which it replaced, and how we, whether we agree or disagree, but the federal general agreement on taxes and tariffs committee of the World Trade Organization and what that impact is at the federal level at this point.
And he did it.
Congratulations.
That's wonderful.
A-OK.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just want to say, for all these show-offs that were members of the Revenue Committee last session, I really showed up today to hear the definitive explanation of the weight mile tax from maybe the two people that understand it. I'm curious for Paul or anybody else that knows whether it appears that the federal government may be attempting to really drive state tax policy by some of these proposals, since states are so different from each other right now.
Yeah,
well, I can let me go ahead and go into
not the weight mile tax, please.
Yeah, I'll go into the weight mile tax later. On Senate Bill 31, I think when I go through that, I think that'll address Representative Boquist's question. But on the comments from Representative Rosenbaum, there, you know, we subscribe to the federal tax administrators and some other organizations that give NCSL that give us the consistent feedback, and there is, that is a criticism of federal policy from the states, is, and I'm sure you hear it from local governments too, that there's not adequate recognition of the implications for states is not taken into account. But certainly those positions are portrayed. There's another issue that's been floating around for a while on nexus and business nexus and federal proposals to change that, which could narrow particularly the state corporate income tax and also limit some of the other taxes that are based on nexus. So that issue has been kind of a controversial one. The states have also pushed very vigilantly some federal support and recognition of the streamlined sales tax agreement. That's been the number one issue for the states, and of course we've only been indirectly involved in that. But those are the things that are being discussed, but I have seen that criticism, and whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it is a common criticism that there's not enough recognition of how the states are affected.
Thank you.
Representative Comp.
Kind of a follow-up to that, Chairman Butler, thank you. Paul, just coming from a regional conference, there was the discussion about taxes between states. You know, we've had the discussion here about how does this impact Washington, Idaho, and California. Is there anything in the future that looks like, you know, particularly maybe when we come down to talking about the telecom communications bill, when we talk about cell phones and, you know, wireless and all that other stuff, is there any talk in those trends out there between states?
Well, as I say, Representative Cobb, I think the main one is over the streamlined sales tax. That agreement is now in place. They've had a critical mass number of states. They've divided them into two groups that are in terms of their level of commitment to it. But, you know, their primary concern and the driving force behind the streamlined sales tax agreement has been the remote sales, the internet.
That is, okay. And that's the basis for it.
Right.
Okay.
And because under federal court decisions, a state cannot tax a business that doesn't have nexus, does not have physical presence in that state. So they can't tax, a Harry and David that's selling products into that state because they don't have physical presence there.
Which should really act as a magnet for business to come to Oregon, I would think, in that process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a competitive advantage that the state has, but, you know, in terms of any interstate commerce, though, you know, you're still not subject to the sales tax. Even if you're in California and you're selling across the border, you're not subject if you don't have a physical presence in that state.
Thank you.
Okay,
please, Paul.
So I'll go ahead and just briefly go into 31 and try to address Representative Boquist's question. The Senate Bill 31, I'm sure you all recall, it passed at 3 a.m. on the night of August 5th, I guess it was. But Senate Bill 31, and I don't remember a session where we had as many important tax and revenue issues in one bill. So, and of course, it's not unusual. I was doing some research on a major tax reform proposal that Ohio passed in their last session, and they had their budget, their entire budget, and their entire tax reform proposal in one bill. So I printed it out, and I'm probably going to raise my printing budget for the interim. But Senate Bill 31 had a series of things, and the most important, of course, was the connection to most of the federal changes. Remember that you did pull out the veterans and military income components and put that in a separate bill. But I listed some of the things there in that report that were important. The Rolling Reconnect reestablished on January 1st of this year, along with most of the changes that had occurred in 2002 and 2003. Repealing and phasing out of the extraterritorial income exclusion was a part of that. Of course, that ended up generating significant revenue for the state. At the federal level, the excluding of the qualified production activities income deduction was the major policy decision that the legislature made, because that was a key element of the federal bill.
I had forgotten about that.
So you want more salt to rub on that?
And the net effect of that in terms of the bill was you had a significant revenue component that the feds had included those two and basically offset in terms of revenue. So you had some adjustments and other components which you used, therefore, to basically make it a revenue-neutral proposal. And the most significant, I think, in the long term was the converting the earned income tax credit to a refundable credit and eventually bumping that to 6%. So that will go into effect the 2006 tax year, and then it becomes 6% in 2008. The corporate apportionment formula was accelerated from July 1, 2008 to July 1, 2005. So corporate tax years beginning on July 1, 2005 or afterwards are now going to be subject to 100% sales apportionment formula. And that could have some interesting results. And one of the things is that we know, for example, that with the profitability of the oil companies, that there should be some additional revenue coming in from those oil companies because of the fact that they're sales only, really. There's no production or activities in Oregon. The other thing that's kind of interesting on how that's turned out is that the $100 million kicker credit that is now going to corporations based on last biennium is based on 2005 tax year liability. So that will be calculated based on what those corporate income numbers are. And it'll be about a 36% credit.
So that would be will that actually reflect on the face of the corporate tax return form, or do they anticipate checks back? Usually it's just shown up on the face.
Yes.
Okay.
And in fact, that's how the personal income tax was done prior to 1995.
Okay.
It's just a credit that you're calculating.
Okay.
So the corporate apportionment formula is now at 100%, and we're watching carefully to see the implications of that. State economists will talk with you about that tomorrow, about what we're seeing in terms of the revenue stream. Frankly, we haven't seen much so far, not as much as we thought we would. We thought it would be reducing revenue more at this point. The research and development credit was expanded. The primary change was to bump the cap from $750,000 to $2 million for an individual corporation. There was an exception put into our throwback rule. And as you recall, on the throwback rule for corporate income taxes, if you have sales to a state which a corporation doesn't have nexus and is not subject to tax, those sales get thrown back to Oregon and become part of Oregon's tax base. You made an exception to this. It's a very narrow exception for a public warehouse in Oregon, which basically would serve as a distribution center. And that was brought to you by the Oregon Trucking Association. And we anticipated a very small revenue impact from that component. The other thing is an issue that Representative Boquist spent a good deal of time working on and became part of your look at incentives for rural medical care, and that was a voluntary emergency medical technicians credit of $250. Finally, there was the Another bill that was tied with that was the property tax law creating exemption for a city or public entity not located in Oregon that owns property rights to the Pacific Northwest Intertie, and this had to do with utilities, publicly owned utilities in Washington.
And colleagues, you'll notice a little later on our work plan that one of the issues deals with the rural health care tax incentives that ties back directly to the voluntary emergency medical technicians credit that we worked on. That's how we tied that back together for an attempt to try and draw some fishing line to pull that issue back to us. So.
Mm-hmm. And in terms specifically on Representative Boquist's question about kind of the qualified production activities, income deduction, and where it stands in terms of federal policy, I don't know where, if there's any specific plans. I've seen a lot of references to potential changes. One that was kind of interesting is in the federal's tax, the president's tax reform group, their proposals eliminated it and went to a new kind of a cash flow measure of corporate income. And they eliminated it quietly, and I saw a number of tax experts refer to that as some indication that the administration may not be fully supportive of it in the future. I don't know where it stands in terms of the discussions about the general agreement on treaties and tariffs. But I think it's, they've got some pretty big issues, and I would imagine would work through their legal process as a challenge, as continuing to be a subsidy. So I know that is being challenged.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, my only concern is, we beat this thing to death last time around, but I guess my point is I think that I'm fairly certain I read that the World Trade Organization, is, and there's a complaint against it that the QPI, pardon my acronym, I can't pronounce it quite. Which replaced the ETI, has been challenged as exactly that, a replacement. Regardless of where you sit, if the feds change it again, we're going to have something else out there which is different from our policy, completely unrelated, that we'll have to realign ourselves or not realign ourselves with, or at least define in our tax code, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, if that does happen, if it's a change, for example, in the tax base as the qualified production activity credit is, you would automatically connect to it. And then, of course, you have to make the decision whether you want to disconnect from that. So you've got that shoe on the other foot now with it rolling reconnect, so you have to react to the changes. Mr. Chair, I'll just refer to some bills that I picked out. It's kind of ones that the committee spent a fair amount of time on. Senate Bill 853 was a credit designed to encourage university-based venture development funds that came out of the Senate, came out of the OCED group. The chair has been very involved, and both revenue chairs have been involved in. That has a unique feature that the credit, there will be a transfer to the general fund on income generated from these funded research activities that become products that we go back to the general fund at a future date. So that might be an interesting one to watch and see how that develops. Senate Bill 996 was designed to encourage affordable housing, and it raised the lender's cap significantly from $6 million to $11 million, and that should generate a fair amount of revenue flowing into the affordable housing. The Senate, by the way, their interim revenue plan calls for that as one of their major items to look at, affordable housing. 2933 was the bill, again, one that Representative Boquist spent a lot of time on, to combine a series of bills, including the reconnect to the Federal Military Family Relief Act of 2003, and those were rolled together. The other element was a retroactive provision for troops assigned to the Umatilla area in 2001 to amend their return so that they wouldn't be subject to taxable income. Remember that our law stated that even if you're on active duty as a guard troop, if you were stationed in Oregon, you were subject to the state income tax. And so that was changed really at the request of the military department. 2450, I'll let Steve talk about that. That was your school distribution formula change modification. And then finally on the 3466, just to make sure that everybody knows that they can still play sports action until July 1, 2007. And that's we're seeing those sales drop already. But what this bill does is repeal the state lottery games based on sports action and dedicates a portion of lottery revenue to collegiate athletics. The important thing about that is that it is a percentage, 1% of the Economic Development Fund, which is the fund before or the fund after dedicated revenue comes out of. And you'll see on the lottery side, you get an update on the lottery forecast. Lottery is also, as the case of the general fund, running over projection. So you have to see what the new estimates are on that. Then finally, I had a list of issues that the committee spent a good deal of time on and still are kind of works in progress. Tax compliance, Senate Bill 480, passed out of the Revenue Committee, a version of it passed the House floor, passed the Senate floor, but it died in conference committee. States continue to enact amnesty laws and voluntary compliance initiatives. Indiana right now is going through one, so we're watching those very carefully, and we'll try to bring back to you the best information we're getting from other states. There was some concern about language that was in the bill. There was discussions between California and Illinois, which was most appropriate for Oregon, and we'll try to research all of that for the committee to bring back what we find. The reserve fund enhancement I mentioned was there is a task force that's been assigned by the joint task force by the Speaker and the Senate President and LFO a staff plan. And the school finance issue that we have our stable schools task force assigned to look at. I've also been directed by the Speaker's office to spend some time and doing some work with the chalkboard project, and they're looking at the school finance issues, and we'll ask them to kind of update the committee on what they've found. They expect to have some recommendations by the spring. So the next thing, Mr. Chair, I asked Steve to kind of walk through with you just briefly kind of where we stand in terms of school finance. This is kind of the last piece. Excuse me.
Not sure whose cell phone that is.
The feds are bugging.
Mr. Chair, Paul?
Yes, Representative Hass.
How much is in the reserve fund now? How much will be available in January 2007?
The Education Stability Fund projected ending balance is $201 million. I believe $168 million is the revenue estimate for this biennium.
So $201 in January of 2007.
That would be in July 1 of 2007. So, but of course, if the lottery forecast goes up, there will be an increase in the estimated 18% of that additional revenue would go into the Stability Fund. Mr. Chair, Steve put together a research report, as he does each session, on kind of where we stand in terms of school finance and going through what happened during the session. And I believe you have that report in your packets. 2005 school finance legislation.
No.
Nope.
Oh, okay.
This one?
Okay.
Chairman, you want to stand at ease?
Sometime last.
No, we'll just continue on. We'll catch up. We're all speed readers here representing kids. Steve, why don't you just go ahead and launch off into it? I think it was in our original packets that were provided. So.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mr. Chair, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. Instead of going through the bills as they are in the packet you just had, I usually take them and reorder things and try to put it together in a separate research report that can expand a little bit more and provide some background, too, in terms of the changes that occurred in the school finance legislation from one session to the next. As Paul mentioned, if you need to go back in history, you can start, I believe it's the 97 session, with something that looks very similar like this research report. I want to deal with three primary issues. One is the state school fund level, the changes made to the formula, and then also a little bit on the funding of education service districts in this process. And what I'll touch on some things that there was no legislation that really affected, but it's still an integral part of the overall funding of school districts. So I wanted to include that, and that's primarily on the local revenue side. If you have the report, please turn to page 2, the first chart on state school fund sources. If you have there, of course, you all remember that the state school fund appropriation was $5.24 billion for the biennium. What this chart shows you is how much came from the general fund and how much from the lottery, with the general fund being a little over 92% and the lottery about 8% of that $5.24 billion. The other thing to note, I think, is that the increase in 05-06 is relatively high compared to 06-07. That's because in 04-05, that's the year that the state school fund decreased. And so you're comparing an increased year to the prior year when it went down in that year. That's what makes the percentage as high as it is. The other thing that's to note here, I guess, is that the appropriations this session was made on a biennial basis. How much was from the general fund? How much from the lottery? There's just a biennial number. Prior years, there was a number for each year. And it was decided to drop the individual year numbers so that it wouldn't cause... potentially would reduce a problem with cash flow from one fund or the other. But that's why that change was made. The other thing that's driving the annual amounts in total for the state school fund is the assumption that both state and local revenue, 49% would be made available in the first year of the biennium, 51% in the second. So that's also driving that split of the state school fund between the 2 years. The other item that this table shows you is a general fund trigger limit of $23 million in 05-06, if you recall that. The trigger depends upon the June revenue forecast in 06. So if the June revenue forecast of the general fund is higher than the close-of-session general fund estimates, then up to $23 million will be transferred into the state school fund for that 06-07 year. So potentially the $5.24 billion biennial appropriation could be at $5.263. And depending on what you see tomorrow, you'll have a better idea of what to expect that June forecast to be.
So that trigger, that additional $23 million trigger, must have been part of the original fiscal package, even though we were basing on close of session forecast, that it reached forward as much as to the June of 06 and pulled some and appropriated an additional up to an additional $24 million based upon that additional forecast then.
Right.
So really what we have is, and let me just kind of approach it from a little bit different direction. If the forecast continues up, then we're actually and it would come up to a point where you would trigger a kicker. You're actually taking a portion of the kicker then too, because you've appropriated and anticipated for it. Help me with that.
Let me answer. Paul will have to address the kicker side.
Mr. Chair, the thing about the kicker, to keep in mind, it is strictly a revenue adjustment. So it doesn't matter what you do in terms of the expenditure side. Let's say we get, revenue 10% above forecast for this biennium. That just goes into the ending balance.
But that's based upon the end of session forecast. did we change the definition of end of session forecast to the June forecast? That was my question.
No, Mr. Chair, we didn't. What the bill did was say that it's a conditional appropriation that if the forecast has gone up by a certain amount, then $23 million goes into the state school fund in addition as appropriated. The kicker will still be based on the close of session, and we account for the kicker on the revenue side strictly in the next biennium, because that's when it would go out as a refund. It cannot affect revenue this biennium.
Okay.
And so it would come out of next biennium.
Great. Thank you very much.
So the potential impact for that is to increase the growth rate of the state school fund from 6.6% to 7.1% if that additional $23 million is available. Okay, if you look on the second page then, page three, that shows you where those state school fund dollars are going. What is new this session, or this biennium, is a appropriation for the virtual school bill to the Department of Education of $2 million for the biennium. There was no split of that $2 million by fiscal year. I have divided it equally because that was the indication from the Department of Education that that's probably about how it would be divided up. The legislature continued the small high school appropriation of $5 million, small high schools in small districts, and also continued providing some money off the top of the state school fund for state special education. That's to provide education in state hospitals and other long-term care facilities for children. The school for the deaf and the blind, for example, is another one. Then the balance goes to the K-12 school districts and the education service districts. You can see that the school districts get about a little over 95% of that remaining balance, and ESD is about a little over 4%. We haven't talked about at all how local revenue comes into play. It can have a little bit of an impact here, but in the bill, you do have a set amount each year for 05, 06, 06, 07 as to the division of that $5.24 billion, and you see those numbers there also.
Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Rowland's recognized.
Yep, thank you. The question I have is on that $23 million. Does it get reallocated through this formula, or does it all go into the school equalization formula of the K-12?
It would all go to the school. Well, it would go to both K-12 and ESDs.
And ESDs.
Okay. Yes. So ESDs would have, I think it's about $1 million more, and the school districts would get about a little over $4 million of, excuse me.
23.
So yeah, it would still be split up about that 95%
okay.
allocation. Okay, then the next table is on local formula revenue on page 4. During the session, there was very little, if any, discussion about local revenue. It was kind of treated as a given. And the revenue didn't change all that much from the beginning of the session to the end of the session as to what was going to be counted as local revenue, what local revenue is to be included in the school distribution formula. Property taxes, of course, are the primary source. It's almost 92% of the total, $2.2 billion. The other sources that you see listed there, the little over $200 million, that's the common school fund, the county school fund, federal forest fees, state managed timber revenue that's shared with school districts. Those are the sources that make up that 8.5% of the total. And that's going to increase, assuming that our estimates are correct. These are all estimates for local revenue. It would be about a 10.7% increase for the biennium. The good news for property taxes, at least that component of local revenue, is that the assumption for 05-06 was for a 4.6% increase in assessed value to drive school property taxes. Early indications are that will probably be close to 5% increase in assessed value for 05-06. So from that standpoint, the forecast is looking good for the property tax portion of local revenue.
Yes, Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. Steve, that figure over here for the biennium of 10.7% increase?
Yes.
Is that figure up or down from the last, let's say, two or three biennium? Do you know?
Probably up a little bit.
Okay.
But I haven't reviewed that, but I don't think it would be up too much because
okay.
The property tax growth has been fairly steady.
Thank you.
The part of the reason I think is that this local revenue hasn't had much discussion is the school revenue forecast committee that's kind of responsible for making this forecast. I'm a member of that committee. But if you recall, that committee is made up of two legislators, a senator and a representative, technicians like myself, and also from the Department of Education, budget management. And then there is a group of people who represent the special interest groups that deal with education. So that makes up the committee, and what the process does then is to make those numbers aware to the interest groups before it even comes to the legislature. That is, the first step is to go through this process and come up with local revenue estimates for the governor's budget. So that's what makes it, I think, or has made it a little bit easier to take local revenue out of the discussion to a certain extent during the session. Okay, what I want to mention on one local revenue source deals with the county school fund and federal force fees. As you recall, Congress passed the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000. What that did was to stabilize the revenue that the districts, the counties in particular, received from the federal government for federal force revenue in a way in place of harvest revenue from cutting trees. That act ends in 2006. So the amount of revenue from that source in 2006-07 is in doubt. And that's what's driving the decrease in the K-12 local revenue from other sources from 109 down to 98. We're kind of hedging our bets. We decided we better not count on all of that money being continued by Congress. And so it was reduced about, I think it was somewhere around $9 million in that process. So that money might be there. It might not. There might be even less than what we're counting on, depending on what Congress does to renew or continue that legislation.
Sure.
One thing to be aware of on the local side.
Thank you. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Yeah, thank you. Just on a yearly basis, what is that amount that goes toward school?
It's currently at about the $33 million a year. And we put it in at about $25 million in 2006-07. Okay, if you'll turn to page 5 then, what this table does is just to put the two earlier tables together to combine the state school fund dollars and the local dollars into one table so that you can see it all together. If you put the state and local dollars together for the equalization formula, you get $7.4 billion for the biennium to be distributed through the formula for a 7.8% increase. For ESDs, note that the 0506 number is lower, the 0607 number is lower than the 0506 number for allocation to ESDs of state and local revenue. Now that's because of the change in the ESD share of funds in that second year of the biennium. As you recall, for funding ESDs, there was a 5-year phase-up of the ESD share of ESD and school district revenue. from about 4.6 to 5%. It hits 5% in 05-06. Then the legislation this last session said for 06-07, though, it's going to decrease to 4.75% rather than 5%. So that's why that is there. So it's going to take the ESD share back down to where it was in 03-04, beginning in 06-07, and then we'll remain at that 4.75% unless the legislature changes it.
So it's fixed to 4.75 from this point forward?
Yes.
And it had been, what, about three sessions ago, well, three or four sessions ago, it was phasing, and it got up to the 5, and now it's dropping back down, and then fixes it 4.75.
Right. Yeah. That's the year one of the five-year phase-in, if I remember correctly, it was their share was 4.6%.
Okay.
So it was stepped up then gradually to the 5.
Okay.
And that also explains why you see 11.9% increase in 05-06, too, because of the step-up driving that percentage higher. All right. The only other revenue issue I wanted to bring up in terms of an appropriation was to the local option equalization fund, $1.2 million for the biennium. That was split into two parts, $400,000 directly to the fund and the other $800,000 to the
E-board,
right. Equalization board for them to distribute. The reason it was done that way is because there were a couple of school districts that it was very iffy as to whether they would qualify for any of those dollars or not. And the $400,000 was already in the budget, and so the extra $800,000 was decided to go to the emergency board, and then they could allocate it to that fund as needed. Okay, you have a diagram there on page 7 as how local and state revenue has changed over the years since the passage of Measure 5 and Measure 50. Just note, I guess, the reductions in 02-03 and again in 04-05, the second year of those two bienniums, and then for 05-06 and 06-07, presumably there will be a steady growth given the accuracy of the local revenue estimates coming to fruition. That's all I wanted to mention on the revenue side. Any questions before going to the formula changes?
Chairman. Any questions? Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. Steve, I know we don't, and I know I'm new at this game, but people don't usually want to talk about the federal funds. But I would love to see the amount of federal funds in a chart just like you did here with the state and the local, because the federal revenue has increased.
Yes.
And so when Representative Berger starts her stable school committee and is looking at those figures, I think that would be a foundation piece that would be help them in their reflections.
You have that information, I think, don't you, Steve, in a separate?
I can put that together, yes.
Okay. That would be very helpful. It would capture in one spot
all of the
resources.
Mm-hmm. You know.
The major might be a little bit different,
sure,
but it would be fairly comparable.
Thank you.
Principal
Thank you.
Resources, I guess, because there are other local funds.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the four major funding sources.
Okay, then if you would turn to page 8, I guess, where we're at. I'm not really going to go through all of the details of the formula. So for the new members, there's some summary information here in terms of how the formula works. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the changes. So it may be a little bit out of context for the new members, but the existing members that were here during the session will pick up on this very quickly. The equalization formula, as you recall, is the sum of four grants, right? The general purpose grant, which is driven by weighted students, the transportation grant, which is basically a percentage reimbursement for transportation costs, the high-cost disability grant, which was started by the 03 session, and then the facility grant, which is a percentage reimbursement for cost of new classroom space. The only one of these grants that got changed to the high-cost disability grant this last session. The facility grant didn't get changed for 05, 07, but there was a change for beginning in 07, 09. So for the high-cost disability grant, just to refresh your memory a little bit, the 03 session decided that for districts that have very high-cost students, that part of that cost of a certain amount should be included in the formula. And the amount chosen was for costs above $25,000.
That item is House Bill 2450 in the earlier packet on page 13 and 14.
So any district that could identify a disability student that was costing them more than $25,000, all of the costs above that $25,000 was eligible to be included in the high-cost disability grant. The legislature, well, they put a sunset on it in 03 because the information that we had at that time was some fairly rough estimates from school districts. We wasn't sure how accurate they were. And so the legislature decided, well, we'll sunset it and let the 05 legislative session take a look at it when there's some actual data to work with. And so during the session, we had the 03-04 data, and that indicated about 2,000 students qualified. The amount of money spent escapes me at the moment. But when it was passed, there was a limit put on it of $12 million that the total grants statewide could add up to. If the eligible costs were above $12,000, they had to be prorated down to that $12,000 limit. That meant that only about 70% of eligible costs were actually covered in the grant to stay under that $12 million cap. So the legislature then had a couple of options. One was to raise the $12 million higher to potentially mean more than 70% would be eligible, or to somehow reduce the eligible costs or the number of students in some manner. The direction that was taken was to increase the threshold from $25,000 to $30,000 and only qualify those costs above that $30,000 amount. The effect of this was then to almost cut the number of eligible students in half. And that then was going to hopefully reduce the administrative costs for the school districts to still have sufficient eligible costs to use up the $12 million. And from the estimates, it looked like then by going to that $30,000 threshold that you would end up being pretty close to 100% of those costs above $30,000 being reimbursed through this grant. So it might not quite make it up to 100%, but it should be close with that change. And there's about 80 districts then that qualify for this grant.
So the students that qualify under the new $30,000 threshold, when you say that would cut the students in half, it goes from about 1,000?
Go from a reduced the 2,000 that were eligible to about 1,000.
To about 1,000, yeah. Okay.
We're not sure how much that will increase. It will probably be more than 1,000, but not sure just how much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Yes, Representative Bullquist.
Follow-up to that, I think when 2450 passed into law, I think I might have been a single vote against it on the floor, so... we were on Model 26, and in the Model 26, it showed that by making these adjustments, we were going to only utilize about $10 million of the $12 million. You and I had this discussion. Where are we now? Because my concern and my reason for voting against it was we were basically reducing it from $12 million to $10 million, and that additional money, as we talked about before in the bill, would roll back into the Common School Fund or the State School Fund, but the assumption... The guess that was made is the next model would increase that. Where are we at now in terms of that $12 million figure in the modeling process?
Chair Representative Boquist, I don't have any more recent data yet. The 0405 data isn't there. So that was based on the 0304 data. And I think given any much of an increase at all and more scrutiny by the school districts to identify these costs, that it will be close to the 12.
And the excess was to go where?
It would roll back into the, not the common school, but the state school,
which
would then be redistributed.
Under the formula.
Under the formula.
Right, okay.
That would be at the end, because this is a cost reimbursement, Mr. Chair. So it would actually be seen at reimbursement after your budget year ends.
Yeah, I thought you said the common school fund. Wait a minute, I didn't remember that.
Mr. Chair, you know, the common school fund isn't a part of this. It's already in the state school fund. It's just a matter of whether it would go through the high cost disability grant or the general purpose grant.
Okay.
The shift which grant it's allocated out from. Okay, the other change was to the facility grant. As you recall, the facility grant allows up to 8% of construction costs to be reimbursed to districts for providing additional classroom space. But this one also has a cap. The current cap was $17.5 million a year, which means that 8% in reality is more like 3 or 4% of their construction costs being allocated through the grant. Beginning in the 07-09 biennium, the $17.5 million goes up to $25 million. So it increases the cap for that facility grant. That should allow that 3 or 4% to go up roughly a percentage. So it might be 4 to 5% that the districts could anticipate from that grant.
It also helps the higher growth districts that can pass bonds to build new schools.
Yes, it does. Okay, so that's a change to look forward to. The rest of the report then basically is just looking at the formula with those changes in it and providing some general summary that you can look at if you want to know more of the details. If you really want to get into the details, there's a separate research report just on the formula itself.
Questions of Steve Meyer, and we do have, set up in our proposed timeline for the work of the committee to come back and revisit the school funding formula sometime during our interim studies here. So that may be ambitious, but it's something that we did not get to in any degree of discussion, with the exception of really 2450, and with the good help of a number of members of the committee in the regular committee, we were able to get 2450 passed, even though one of the members of the committee even voted against it on the floor. So, any further questions of Mr. Meyer? Thank you very much, Steve. We appreciate you being here and taking us through the school funding, school finance legislation. Paul?
Okay, Mr. Chair, the last thing we have on your agenda for this afternoon is the draft interim work plan, and that's listed as draft, depending on the input we get from the committee members. I think you all had this emailed to you and should have it here in your packet. There's actually two pieces to it. One is the draft work plan. The other is the proposed timeline that the chair just referred to. And, but in terms of the work plan itself, these are based on discussions I've had with the chair and with the vice chair, and discussions of issues that came up in the last session. But I think it would be fair to say it's a living document in terms of issues.
Yeah, colleagues, I don't want this to be a dictated work plan of what we absolutely will be limited to. These were issues that were still left on our plate, I thought, somewhat. You'll see that some of them are items, for instance, when you look at 480, the tax compliance. I think that actually I'm going to commend the regular session committee for having done really, really good work on 480. I think 480 passed out of here as an excellent piece of legislation and went somewhere else and got battered up and was just didn't go anywhere. So I'm certainly open to suggestions. We have submitted this major issues draft to the speaker's office of items that we still had pending or felt like that they were issues that were of significant enough importance. And while there were items that actually passed as legislation from the House, we picked them back up as items that we felt that were still pending. So we may not have absolutely agreed with the way they passed the House or where they didn't get through the Senate, or even when they did get through the Senate. If you look at 408, for instance, I don't know how many of you are on the 408 list, Senate Bill 408 relative to the interim or to the utility taxation, but that has opened Pandora's box, unfortunately, and many of the alternative energy credits and the green power credits now go wanting for the passage of Senate Bill 408, creating a real debacle in Oregon's progress with regard to many of those issues. So that's an issue that I had asked that we'd be able to come back, and we didn't address that as a committee. Our committee was already closed by the time 408 passed the Senate. So it was handled in another committee and worked in that other committee, and there were some work groups on it. So if having gone through this either today or sometime in the next couple of months, if you'll review this and make any recommendations or suggestions of other items that need to be added. I think one item, the number two item there, evaluation of tax expenditures. I know that Representative Dingfelder and Representative Haas and myself and other members have looked at this and said, are we really accomplishing the things that we said that we wanted to accomplish when we had tax credits or deductions afforded in the tax code? And I Paul has a kind of an exhaustive, well, I think pretty good file that Representative Dingfelder and I had put together in the interim or during the regular session of things that we were concerned and how we would study it. And while we couldn't put that into any legislation, we felt like that if we knew that we were going to come back and take a look at the tax expenditures, that would give this committee an opportunity to certainly put our order back in there. And I think actually the Senate's addressing of the tax expenditures is much more aggressive than what we have as a House, and so maybe we'll split off in some informal work groups with members assigned from this committee to attend and be available to work with any of the folks in the Senate, because, as I say, their approach is a little more aggressive. They're not just going to look at it. They're putting a number on it and saying, we're going to look at it to see, you know, how much or where we can make cuts in order to actually gin up new revenues. So, and that's a prerogative of the House, not of the Senate. So I would appreciate it if when that time comes, that we might have as many as four volunteers from this committee serve informally with the Senate committee to bring us back some kind of a consensus as to how we might incorporate what it is that they come up with ideas in addition to our own. So, working document, no pride in authorship amongst ourselves as I've put this document together. Just kind of was what was left on the plate as we left town in August. Other comments or questions regarding the interim work plan and the proposed timeline? Now, you'll notice on the proposed timeline, Paul, did you want to spend any time on that?
Just if there are any questions about the issues themselves, I think one of the things that's probably worth noting is on the utility taxation that Chair referred to, Senate Bill 408, and that's in here as well, but it also affect some of the other issues as well. For example, on the property tax side, we have the issue of intangibles and centrally assessed property, which is a subcomponent of that. And we have been in discussions with the Department of Revenue. And by the way, John Phillips is here.
I'm going to just ask John to come forward, if you would, please, John, while we've got you here, because you're putting together some actual hearings, and I received your email on that. I think that would be appropriate for us, just because of the intangible taxation, centrally assessed, and those kinds of things. Kind of give us a flavor of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Phillips, Department of Revenue. Yes, we have begun some meetings and started some not really hearings, but getting together folks on these issues.
You have already started the meetings?
Yes, we have.
Oh, okay. All right. I just got the email from you. I didn't realize they were already started.
Well, we've started the organizational process.
Oh, okay.
And we had one meeting, and we decided we need to expand the group a little bit, so we've thrown the net a little wider and trying to get everybody involved.
John, I sent your email out to the Oregon Telecommunications Association and to the Quest, trying to encourage more of the actual phone companies to participate more than, I think AT&T was on your list, and I'm not sure who else, but I would like to know, you know, that all of the phone companies that had concerns about centrally assessed utilities were having an opportunity to participate.
Very good, Mr. Chair. We put as many as we identified on there, and then we also indicated that anybody else that was interested or anybody that was aware of anybody else that was interested, let those people know, and to the extent they want to participate.
What kind of a meeting schedule, and where will you be meeting and so forth, John?
Well, if I might step back just a minute to give you a little better idea what our plan is, just briefly. I know your time is important, but we divided it into four segments. And the first segment, just like any bureaucracy would do, we just are over-planning this. So. But the first segment was to deal with a basic review of and a rewrite for readability. The central assessment statutes were created originally in 1909. And because they deal with such a narrow scope of companies, which
probably hasn't been a lot of change in telecommunications since 1909, I wouldn't think.
Well, there's two tracks, yes, sir, Mr. Chair. There's the law, and then there's what's happening out there, and the two tracks haven't necessarily kept pace. Exactly. So we do have the authority by the Department of Revenue to assess and appraise all wagons, horses, telegraph companies. There aren't a lot of those around anymore, and so, I mean, there are a lot of areas that could use some just general modernization. The first track is strictly that, and we're trying to focus just on that, and that's one of the reasons why we invited a broad range of participation, so that anything we do does not spill over into a policy or substantive area in this review. We just want a strictly like a cleanup, a house cleaning. The second level of review is focused on gaps. We have an assessment and appraisal system for residential commercial properties. That is where a lot of the changes in the law have come over the last, you know, decades. It's not really kept pace in the central assessment area. So in areas like maybe a role correction where a mistake is made and there's a correction or appeals processes or something like that, we want to look for gaps so that we don't end up having lawsuits and spending state money for litigation because of gaps. The third area would be to deal with issues of policy, and this is something we would brainstorm at the department and with our stakeholders and say, taxpayers, and say, what hasn't kept pace? For example, we're supposed to assess and appraise communications companies, and that is one area where we traditionally thought of that as two-way communication. And what is that? That's a telephone. That's a telegraph. Now, today, it could be a pager, it could be voice over internet, it could be cable companies. We don't appraise cable companies, but one might argue that they fall into the definition of communication. So if we were to go out and start appraising cable companies, they would be rightfully concerned, because when you move from an appraisal of a residence or a commercial to a centrally assessed company, you all of a sudden bring in the intangibles, which are not assessable under the residential commercial laws. They are under centrally assessed. So any change we make by an interpretation, is really a policy question. And so we want to try to surface those issues for you and again, keep us out of court. And, you know, we want to be doing what you want us to be doing. The fourth level is a level that was raised last session about intangibles themselves. And so this is not an area where we're intending to come up with a solution and bring a bill to you all. What we want to do in this process is examine it, look in, and work with Legislative Revenue Office, look at other states to see what they're doing about intangible taxation, and be prepared to answer your questions in whatever policy direction you want to go. We'll hopefully be able to help you with Legislative Revenue and staffing that.
Have you broken up into four work groups then? Is that what you're doing? Or are you just handling those? Everyone is working on all four items.
Well, Mr. Chair, primarily we've launched level one, and we've gotten the utility team, which is our six or seven appraisers that just appraise all of the companies in that area. And then they started going through the statutes one by one, and we're meeting with legislative council, legislative revenue, and then we're expanding that group. So we've got that on track every Wednesday, every Wednesday until we're done. The second level, we've begun to identify issues where there are gaps. And right now we're looking at experts in the field, appraisers, counties, our internal folks to identify gaps. The third level is we've started a list of those things. Communications definition is right on the top of that list. And we haven't actually gathered the group yet, but that's our intention.
Let's see. Representative Rosenbaum, you're a member of Senate Bill 17 Committee on Telecommunications.
That's right.
I believe that Senate Bill 17 probably fits into some of both the policy issues as well as potential gaps right now, and then eventually into the intangibles. So I think it would be important that, John, we maybe somehow from you on a regular basis receive an update of your regular Wednesday meetings, and I'm anxious that we work together with the department, particularly where the utility taxation is an item which was still on our plate, and then the Senate early on saw it with regard to Senate Bill 17, which I believe came from the Oregon Telecommunications Council, personally.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and honestly, I have not looked back at the original legislation to see exactly what the scope of that task force is, because I know it's supposed to pretty much review all the telecommunications code legislation, but I don't know whether it might have excluded taxation or approached it.
Well, it sounds like
you're right.
It sounds like, Representative, that we're going to be that the department is working in their own direction on some of these issues, and I think it would be very important, not that they're trying to establish policy, but I think it would be very important that we work together when that proceeds. And I think the Senate has members, the House has members, and then I think the governor actually appoints the 60% of the work group. Together.
Mr. Chair, it occurs to me that this piece of the discussion might be livelier than just reviewing all the nitty gritty of the telecom.
Okay. But John, I would appreciate it if you keep Legislative Revenue Office, Representative Rosenbaum, and myself at least in that loop on your Wednesday meetings. Just a brief report on where you're at as you're continuing to proceed. Again, I looked down that list and kind of saw who was on it, and then I submitted that on to a couple of telecommunications folks with Quest and the Oregon, what is it, OTA, Oregon Telecommunications Association, because I know that they would be interested in the result of that. So. And they haven't. Only one of the two got back to me to let me know that they were going to examine the scope of where the department was going. Again, very weighty items, and we'll have a few months in which to work on those. Further questions, Representative Barnard for
a different topic.
Different topic. Okay. Any further questions for John
Chair,
Phillips?
If I could just interject here for our new members. The Department of Revenue assigns two people to the committee as our staff, and really full time during the session. And John Phillips works on all the property tax issues, so you'll see John on a regular basis. And Debbie Buchanan sitting in the back does all the corporate and personal income tax issues. So they keep us well informed on what the department's doing, and of course for us. You know, that's our source of data is the tax returns, and they work with us on that and on any administrative issues and revenue department issues. They're available for it.
These are two really very intelligent and dedicated people, and thank heavens they both got pretty thick skins too, because sometimes the cogitating over issues of taxation, these folks get pushed on pretty hard. Representative Barnard, you had a question?
Well, actually, it was a suggestion or a comment on the proposed interim work plan, if I may.
Please.
I think several of the issues that you've got listed here touch at least tangentially on the issue that I want to raise, and this may be a third rail in some ways for a state House committee. But one of the things that's happening in dealing with cities and counties in the last several years is the run-up against the Measure 5 and 50 property tax limitations, compression, and so forth. And a number of them are now facing significant revenue shortfall problems as a result of that and other things. I'm thinking about franchise fees and a variety of other issues that relate to local revenues. And they're struggling with those issues. It occurs to me, although there's a lot in this and there's a lot on your plate, you may want to spend a little time thinking about how that's likely to impact the delivery of public services by cities and counties and the extent to which this committee might have something to say about that.
Representative Barnard, that's an excellent observation. And while the review of the property tax system does have measures 5 and 50 issues that we will be taking a look at, or we hope to, the list is of seven different items, and be aware that the Senate committee is limiting themselves to four items. They just don't work as effectively as we do. I guess is one way.
Fewer of them.
And the other is that there's just fewer of them to go around. I would also say this in regard to that, and where I believe that a review of the property tax system will include that. Senator Schrader and the Ways and Means process has, and at last count, I think we're up to about eight different budget notes that deal with county and state common supplied services, and where we have. A common delivery mechanism. And so anyone who has direct and regular associations with Senator Schrader and you have interest in this issue of the local city county arrangements, local government arrangements, please volunteer your services to Senator Schrader, because, and I, as I'm looking around the room here, I'm seeing some folks that could be of great benefit in offering your services to any of the, and those are informal work groups. They come out of budget notes to say, you know, how are we going to deliver community correction services with the state putting less money into it? How are we going to continue to have our district attorneys funded while we're cutting back at the state level, hoping that the local level will pick up the freight? I had a very excellent conversation with one of my circuit court judges yesterday who said, you know, is there some reason that the legislature hates judges? You know, I mean, we've gone all these years with no raises and then they start talking about cutting our compensation. So I anything that you can do to be of assistance to Senator Schrader and be a resource in those issues, that would be of help as well. Other items?
Mr. Chair, just kind of a follow-up on that. On your last page there, we have kind of a list of monitoring issues, and I think probably some of Representative Barnard's comments might fit under the significant local revenue policy changes, which sometimes will come up as an issue and be brought before you. But the one that has typically come up in the past, and is, of course, very hard to predict, is the voter initiatives. And so it's, you know, we do have a number of petitions, and I don't know how much is being circulated, how serious they are, but we have one, a number of corporate minimum tax change proposals, one that would change how we treat the personal exemption credit and make it treated as the federal deduction as a deduction, as the feds treat the exemption. So, you know, those kinds of issues could come up and could become, you know, very big by September of next year. So we have typically saved some time to make sure you have a chance to delve into some of those issues if they emerge.
Well, the initiative process is always a scary one in some respects. Representative Rosenbaum is recognized.
Mr. Chair, Paul's comment just reminded me that I have heard some legislators of both parties talking about the potential of a cigarette tax initiative to fund some sort of health care, and there seem to be different versions of it. I haven't actually seen anything yet, but that seems to be one thing that's floating around, too.
You know, has that been filed with the Secretary of State's office? Do we know?
I haven't seen it, but I don't watch that website every day.
Okay. Yeah, I think that that fortunately will be meeting through the times when those issues may or may not make it to the ballot, and then I think we can adjust our overall work plan and schedule accordingly. I'll even get some bipartisan legislation there. Representative Galizio's right.
This is I think a pretty good segue. We took that field trip. We looked at other tobacco products.
Mm-hmm.
Any thought to doing something along those lines? You're trying to avoid any kind of metaphor.
I had the opportunity to stop by that warehouse last week to pick up my regular smokes. the other tobacco products are absolutely selling off the shelves. It's moving to be the largest single, and that's other than chew and other than cigars, the other tobacco products are really taking off. And as Oregon, our tax on that is 65%. Of the wholesale price is what it is, and I think that, I don't think I'm talking out of school, but I'm going to go ahead and give you the quote. That tobacconist that we went and visited told me that originally when that passed, the check that he was writing, the quarterly check or month, I think it may be a monthly check. I don't remember. How often the check is, but the check that he was writing, it's a quarterly check, with his deposit was around $20,000 for the 65%, so you can figure out how much his actual merchandise cost was. He showed me on his desk a check for over $200,000. In other words, that's gone up 10 times at the same rate. Of the use of other tobacco products. Again, that check also would include chew and cigars, but his comment was the majority of that is into roll your own tobacco products is where it's coming from. So, and what I tried to get from him then was the equivalent, you know, number of sticks of cigarettes that makes, and they do a calculation on that, but there's a rather significant move and switch in the overall consumption there, and I think Representative Boquist had some proposal that we continue to use our very best technology, and you know that my hope is that we might be able. Is there anyone here that serves as a member of the technology, the JLCIMT? Because if we had someone from technology in that process, it would be a great resource to be able to do that. Because that tobacco does not have the chew cigars and those kinds of things have no ability to trace them. There's no again all of the tax is at the wholesale level only, and once it's taxed, you just move it from one side of the room to the other side of the room and say there we received it. We paid the invoices and here's the tax on it. So now they move it into the tax channel, and really you're on kind of best behavior with regard to that kind of stuff. And I know that the service or the Department of Revenue has really very closely monitored the other tobacco products because that was one of my questions. How do they audit that? How do they audit the fact that you've moved this from from the receiving line into the taxed distribution line, and that was one of the comments, was that, you know, we have a very careful method of doing that here. Everything that's invoiced into us, we very carefully filter it out of the stream. But he said the comment was, you know, not everybody is as necessarily as careful as we are, because, goodness gracious, if you can drop your overall wholesale costs by 65%, you know, you'd be foolish not to try that. But it's, I want to go on record to say that it's patently illegal to do that, but, you know, some folks don't much care when it comes down to the bottom line. So
does that mean it's not under the purview of this committee? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know that it is or isn't. Any revenue issue that will be coming before the next legislative assembly should be considered by this committee by November or by December of 06, a year and a month from now. So, Representative Galizio, you have an interest in this. Many other members of this committee have an interest in this particular issue. I can see that we're going to have the potential of an informal work group, so we'll keep you in mind.
And, sure. Thank you.
And Paul, an informal work group can have any of the non-committee members and as many as five of the committee members. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. You just can't have a quorum of the committee.
So we could have as many as five from the committee, and that would be less than the quorum, and then other members of the Legislative Assembly and non-members of the committee who may be participating could participate in that. Thank you.
Hey,
Representative Boquist, right.
Sure, for the record, I would like to serve on that work group too, because I think there are some definitional issues under the revenue code, our revenue code, that we address that. Because I would question, not only are we talking about rolling your own, I think we saw the members of the committee that attended that field trip, or whatever you want to call, we saw their repackaging techniques that had products that were, in fact, for all practical purposes, cigarettes, repackaged in a manner that made them not cigarettes. So therefore, we're back at Reed's, Rick's, and other things. How do you define the carrot here? How do you define the cigarette? I think those are revenue issues.
I was plumb amazed at the difference between a cigarette and a cigar.
Yeah.
When you look at it, the difference between the two, you say, wait a minute, that sure looks like a cigarette, but it isn't. So I'm not, there are some definitional issues. And working with us, both in the past, historically, and currently, Pete Shepard from the Attorney General's office and others are continuing to monitor that, and they are most anxious to have whatever kind of work that we can do to give assistance in that regard. We want to get our arms around the NPMs and other tobacco, the non-participating manufacturers who are shipping this stuff in as well.
Mr. Chair, they will be with the committee tomorrow as part of your agenda, so we'll have the AG come and kind of update you on the master settlement agreement and then any other issues you want to talk about.
So I think that's the last item on our agenda tomorrow. Representative Galizio, I think it would be appropriate that maybe the committee could give them some kind of charge tomorrow if you wanted to be prepared to do that. I think that would be appropriate relative to some of these issues and some of the issues that Representative Boquist has brought up. Colleagues, anything further for the good of the order for today?
If I could add something, Mr. Chair, just on the dates, just so you have some dates to work with there and your proposed timelines. You're set up so that your meetings will center around the revenue forecasts, and I've got them listed as March and June, but we do have tentative dates on those forecasts. March 1 would be for the March forecast. And that sounds obvious, but it usually isn't that way. And actually June 1 for the June forecast. And September is August 31st.
So please begin to mark your calendars, if you would, please, colleagues, for those three dates that we...
So we'll either meet on those days, Mr. Chair, or, you know, the day before or after. So it'll be right around then.
Okay. Representative Roblin is recognized.
Good. Or most of the times we come together will be 2 days like this, where we've come the day before and then here on the revenue day, or just the one, we don't know yet.
I don't anticipate, this is where it's an organizational meeting. I don't anticipate that we would be doing two-day meetings as a typical. This is really out of the norm. But to try and coordinate with both the Senate and get the revenue date as well as or the revenue forecast as well as to try and line up our committee meetings and work schedule.
So blocking it up just the one day.
One day, I think will be adequate at that time. Representative Roland. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Mr. Chair, if you're amenable, the Revenue Department prepared a report, 4 or 5 page report on intangible property taxes for me 2 or 3 months ago. And if you're amenable, I'd be happy to pass it to Paul and have him distribute it to committee members.
That I would appreciate it. That would be very helpful. That'll give us some start for the. Building taxation. Okay. Representative Comp is recognized.
Chairman Butler, just for clarification then, so these are the scheduled meetings that you're proposing, and that then you're going to have, we'll have subcommittees that work.
And rather than subcommittees, it'll just be informal work groups.
Right.
Representative Comp, we're working towards an informal work group right now relative to tobacco taxation.
Right.
And
okay.
So I have a couple of members who have already bubbled to the surface on the tobacco taxation issue with regard to taxation of other tobacco products and compliance. So
my question is going to be, as we proceed throughout the year, you'll stay in communication with us through Paul and other initiatives come up, then we'll...
Yes, and that's a good point, Representative Comp. Thank you. Colleagues, this in the interim, there is a vice chair. Representative Berger is the vice chair. And I'm going to rely upon both Representatives Berger and Haas to be of assistance to me, and I'll try and communicate with them. But the chair's prerogative is to go ahead and name these informal work groups at any time without the necessary meeting of a formal meeting.
Good. Okay.
And so as these issues come up, and I'm now looking back at John Phillips and saying, you know, I really am anxious about what the department is doing, because I think it's something that we want the full benefit of, and it would be most helpful to have a member or members of the committee really tied into that. And I'll charge John with making sure that each Wednesday we get at least a one-page email report to each member of the committee and those interested parties. To make sure that we know kind of the things that they're talking about, and then if you have interest in participating, I'm anxious to see that this really dovetails with some of the things that we had left on our plate last session relative to intangibles, and unfortunately I think some good legislation got passed and passed the House and the Senate, and then the governor's staff said, wait a minute, that really isn't what we had in mind, and we did get one bill vetoed in that regard that dealt with some taxation of local utilities. So I'm anxious that we're participating with them and have a voice at the table, because it'll be something that will come back before the Revenue Committee, however it's constituted next session.
Thank you for your clarification.
You bet. Thank you for your interest, Representative Trump.
I'm not into tobacco, but other things I'm into.
And you know what?
You don't roll your own?
I don't. As I look up and down, up and down the committee, I don't see a lot of members that may be into tobacco. And that probably isn't such a bad deal when you're standing in the midst $2 or $3 million worth of all of that tobacco product to have no interest in any of it. But I think that it just takes a lot of gray matter and brain power to try and figure these things out, but
yeah.
I'm convinced that we have it here to be able to do that. Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your participation today. I want to thank you also for your decorum and for basically working with the chair and with all my warts, foibles, and follies. I'm just one of you, today a peacock, tomorrow a feather duster, so please continue to work with me, and I'd be happy to work with you in any way I can, And I express again my gratitude for your kindness and cooperation. With that, please set your alarms for 8:30 tomorrow to be here. And we will be meeting with the Senate jointly for the revenue forecast at 8:30. So we will not have, we won't have the availability of as many spaces. But please plan to participate and come and join with us as we invite the Senate members, the Senate Revenue Committee, to receive the forecast at 8:30. So with that, colleagues, we will stand adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning.
Good to see you, Mark. 8:30.